Well, I'm a progressive mind, I hope. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm here again this week for News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. We've got an interesting program for you, an exciting program for you. You're going to meet a gentleman who's here all the way from the country that's had the longest world war in history, probably, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Djack Munya is here in the studio. He's one of the great rappers of Africa and of the Congo, and you're going to hear his music on this program in the second half hour. We're going to start off talking about Newtown with Russ Baker, the investigative journalist who's been investigating the people who are selling all those assault rifles. And he's going to tell us about what the real issues are in this whole gun control battle. So that's what's coming up on News Dissector Radio today. But first, a little premiere of a new song, which I just heard about an hour ago. It's called Which Side Are You On? It's a version of a song produced in the 1930s by Florence Reese. It's been redone by Pepper Spray Can. That's obviously not the real name, but there it is. And listen to this. Check it out, people. You haven't heard it before. Which side are you on? A good question.
The country, they built the middle class, unions and inventors, the teachers and the brass. But now it's run by players, a zero-sum game, buying politicians, and the unions get the blame. Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
Thank Polarity One for letting us premiere this new version of Which Side Are You on News Dissector Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. Well, we're in what's called the season to be jolly. It's Christmas time. The streets are filled with traffic lights, people shopping, and all the rest of that. But there's a pall hanging over America, hanging over our world. It's the pall of violence, which Americans connected with in a shocking way when 20 young children, I mean young children, were shot down in an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut. And now our president says he is going to try finally to do something about guns. And he's proposing, or he will propose in the new year, probably a ban on assault weapons. But there's a lot more to this issue. There are a lot of interests that don't want anything done on this issue. And one of the crack investigative reporters in our country, Russ Baker, on the whowhatwhy.com website, has been analyzing this and looking into this. Thanks for joining us, Russ, on the program today. And I'd love you to synthesize, if you would, your findings in the recent article you just posted.
Danny, basically, I took a look at one entity, Dick's Sporting Goods. You may know that the authorities in Connecticut had been trying to find out whether there had been some report that the shooter in Newtown had attempted to purchase a gun at a Dick's Sporting Goods about 12 miles away in Danbury. They don't think he did. They still don't seem to know where his weapons came. Well, some of them were his mother's, but whether one of those may have come through his own purchase. And so this company, Dick's, is suddenly in the news. They immediately responded by announcing a couple of measures they were going to take in response to this. One is that it has halted all sales and displays of guns, and then dot, 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 at the store closest to Newtown. Okay.
Beautiful.
Okay. Yeah, and the second one is that it is ceasing sales of, quote, modern rifles nationwide, except you have to add the word temporarily to the term ceasing. And what I did was on our website, whowhatwhy.com, I began drilling down a little bit into Dick's Sporting Goods to see what it was. I live in New York City. Those of us who are in places like this are sort of sheltered from the big chains that dominate America. But it turns out Dick's has about 500 stores and is opening more at a rapid clip.
500? That's a giant chain, isn't it?
It's a giant chain. It's very highly ranked on the New York Stock Exchange. By the way, I find when I talk about these things and I say things like opening at a rapid clip, I realize they're all unintended puns about the violence in our society. But anyway, so as I looked at them, I found that it looks to me like even though they carry a broad range of things, that guns are a big part of their business. They don't carry handguns, but they carry all kinds of other weapons, including these semi-automatic so-called hunting rifles, which are distinguished by the gun owners as from assault rifles. And yet I found an article in which a woman was quoted that she went over to buy a gun there, and then she says, and then it says, I'm here to get an AR-15 for only $7.99, describing a semi-automatic assault rifle on sale at the Dick's store at the Tulsa Hills Shopping Center. So not being a gun owner, so the gun owners, of course, immediately jumped on our website and started saying, you don't know the difference between these things. That's not an assault rifle. But the truth of the matter, of course, is that all of these things can kill an awful lot of people very, very quickly. And so I think the focus of this particular article, and I'm happy to discuss the broader issues as well, but the focus of this particular issue, this particular article, is that companies, big companies that we invest, that we own stock in, or funds that we are invested in, own stock in, places like Dick's, they are dependent on the constant growth in the number of weapons out there in America. This is a big, big part of where the profits come from in our society, and I think we need to look much more closely at these entities, and certainly this Dick's Sporting Goods is probably one of the more benign ones if you compare it to some of them. But I did notice, for example,
but when you hear that name, Russ, Dick's, you know, it sounds like some homey, you know, guy who's been selling, you know, rifles. It doesn't sound like a big corporate chain.
Well, I think it was when Dick first opened it up, but, you know, of course, it exploded and became, pardon the pun again, a giant corporation. One of the things that strikes me about these outfits is that, for example, Dick's gets a lot of credit for, I noticed that I pulled up their corporate report and they were had a big page on corporate responsibility, and they talked about how they donate sports equipment to youth and they are involved with trying to help treat childhood cancers and so on. And of course, everybody loves that, but the truth is that the amount of free advertising that these companies get through these so-called benevolent acts is enormous. And then, of course, not all of it is so altruistic, and I noted that they got a lot of credit for their diversity. A quarter of their executives are women. Everybody thinks it's terrific, but in fact, they're so eager to get women involved in their business that they are targeting women and encouraging them all to get guns. And so one of the things is they are offering pink air rifles, pink, at the stores because they want the ladies to get involved. And so what's happening is our society is just basically totally wigged out. I mean, you know, you say you've got your guest in the studio there, coming from, Congo, I guess. I mean, my God, those people have had to live with horrific violence their entire lives. And this country is just a powder keg. There's no honest discussion of that because we're all overwhelmed and afraid of the NRA and its political power, and because we all have friends or we know people who have guns. And, you know, they haven't killed anybody, so therefore we feel a little bit nervous about discussing whether we're quite sane in this country in terms of our sort of love affair with killing machines.
The NRA has announced that they're going to make a statement tomorrow, and they haven't really said what the statement is, but they're going to make some sort of statement of social responsibility and restraint, perhaps even sign on to some sort of limited registration system for people buying these rifles. Clearly, you know, they were very stung by all this. They took down their website. They took down their Facebook page. You know, some of the people have called them. You know, they have said people should call them at their office. I'm sure you can't get through to their office. So they're trying to get out in front of all of this anger with some sort of, Dix-like social responsibility agenda, which we have to wait until tomorrow to find out about. But it doesn't, I don't think that the NRA is going to change its basic agenda, do you?
No, and in fact, one of the reasons, Danny, that I started WhoWhatWhy.com was because I got so fed up with the media always buying this stuff. It's like Charlie Brown and Lucy in Peanuts, where she says, "Now I'll hold the ball, and you come running by and kick it." And he goes, "I'm not going to do it because you're just going to pull that ball away." No, I won't do it this time. You know, I mean, and then of course she does, and the media feels such a sense of obeisance to the big corporations and big organizations. Organizations that they instead of just honestly saying, we think these people are lying, we don't buy it, we think they have internal meetings and memos where they talk about how can we get away with doing as little as possible. That's obviously what's going on, because, you know, hey, if you and I owned a business, that's what we do. We're not in business not to make money. If we're the NRA, we're not in business not to promote the interests of gun manufacturers. I mean, and so why would we do more than we had to do? We'll do as little as we can. And I think the kinds of things you're going to see are these tiny little incremental things. I mean, it is, you know, these people do have to call this, the stores call this NICS, N-I-C-S, this FBI database to see, whether these people have convictions or anything like that. But, of course, the truth of the matter is because there tend not to be these waiting periods in general, I mean, most people don't have records, or if they have records, they have records for the wrong things. They have records for, you know, maybe they were selling drugs or something, but that doesn't mean they're going to necessarily go out and kill somebody. A lot of these people who kill people are just somebody who you know, whether they're on medications that make them crazy, or whether they've got a temper problem, or they're vengeful, or whatever it is. There are a million different reasons that anybody who has never killed somebody before will kill them, given the opportunity. And so I think what we're going to see is NRA and places like Dick's, you know, saying, well, you know, maybe we could have a little more like, you know, a gun responsibility flyer, you know, that is given out with a gun.
And a forum, you know, perhaps, you know, or a website that will talk about gun safety or
something. Right.
The minimal thing. Russ,
like.
Wait a minute. Just hold 1 second, please. I want to just give out a number here, 888-874-4888, if you want to call in and join this conversation, 888-874-4888. If you want to listen to this program on the phone, you can call 832-280-0066. And the toll-free number here is 877-627-5065. So those are some numbers if you want to participate in this discussion. As we look at this, there's very little linkage made between the amount of weapons the United States produces and sells overseas. This is not just a domestic problem. This is a global problem. I think U.S. is the number one weapons seller in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, look, supplying any form of violence, broadly cast, is a giant part of our economy. And if you look at most big companies, I remember when I was in business, one of the best clients you could have was the U.S. military. I mean, this was even true if you were selling really innocuous things like stuffed animals. I mean, you know, that's the big customer. And so all of these companies, whatever they make, whether it's trucks or it's computers or whatever, they want to get in on the action. And so what you're talking about, the pure armaments themselves, are an enormous industry. And you know, this explosion of wars under Bush and then under Obama, with the United States involved in more and more and more of these interventions, Syria, perhaps Iran, Libya, what have you. I mean, it's all more fodder. It's more opportunity for these companies. And this, what saddens me the most is that there is no accountability for those who don't find this to be problematical, who could earn a comfortable living doing something else, but to choose to do this instead. And so they always say, well, listen, like these guys who are divesting, the Cerberus Capital is divesting, getting out of, they owned the Bushmaster company, the gun that killed the children as teachers at the school. They're getting out of, they said, look, you know, we were in these things because, you know, we're just, you know, don't ask us. I mean, we're just trying to make a buck, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. In their case, you had the California pension fund of the teachers in California, state employees who put pressure on this hedge fund, who are invested in this hedge fund, to drop their investments in these gun companies. So they didn't do it for altruistic reasons, that's for sure. We have someone on the phone. Join us. Hello.
Hi there.
Comment, thoughts, question?
My thoughts are that the NRA should not be catching a backlash for what happened in Connecticut. I even think that if the teachers would have been armed, maybe this could have been prevented. So that's just my thought on that.
How would you see this? In Michigan, they passed a state law that allowed people to carry weapons in schools, and now it's been vetoed by the governor, who feels that it's likely to be unsafe. A lot of people have studied all of this, say the thought, there's a kind of naive thought that somehow if people are armed, they'll be able to retaliate and these things won't happen, when in fact, the more people are armed, the more incidents like this tend to happen. Any thoughts on that, Russ, this comment?
Sure. I mean, to me, this caller's idea doesn't sound wise. I mean, I just went to the optician and was having some trouble with the eye charts. And, you know, I mean, even if we were to assume that everybody you give a gun to is not going to use it for ill purposes, let's say they're just trying to defend their students and here comes this gunman, I mean, what is the likelihood that they're going to hit him? What is the likelihood they're not going to hit other children or other teachers who may be rushing behind the gunman? What is the likelihood that they're not going to miss or maybe wound him, but not critically, and not cause him to go even more insane and to kill more people, including those people with
Is our caller still with us? Are you still there? Hello? I wanted to ask her if she has any connection with the NRA, because I'm reading that, you know, NRA members are encouraged to call the media.
Oh, is that right?
And to... And to try to disconnect, divert this issue. Kat Waters, who's usually here in the studio, is on the phone. Do you have a thought on this, Kat? Are you armed?
I'm armed with, I guess all I'm capable of being armed with, but no, I don't pack a firearm, if that's what you're referring to. But I just wanted to bring up the fact that, you know, these last two shooters, the Sandy Hook and the Aurora guy, you know, both of their fathers were involved in some high finance, and they were supposed to testify at LIBOR. And it just has been coming out lately that the idea that these shootings are just a distraction or some kind of a diversion away from these two fathers who are working in this big business and supposed to be testifying against LIBOR.
I mean, I've read about that, but, you know, there is a kind of thing we call guilt by association. The U.S. government has just prosecuted the UBS firm, which is a big Swiss bank. And the Wall Street Journal reports, you know, today that UBS has admitted rigging rates in this epic plot of LIBOR. And, you know, they quote two of their traders, a broker and a trader, on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, which is very interesting. The broker says to a UBS trader, "Mate, you're getting bloody good at this LIBOR game. Think of me when you're on your yacht in Monaco, won't you?" And the other quote from a trader, "I need you to keep it as low as possible. If you do that, I'll pay you, you know, $50,000, $100,000, whatever you want. I'm a man of my word." The point about all of this is that we've been on this show for, you know, as long as there's been a show, talking about financial crime, talking about the way the banks in this country operate. I wrote a book, The Crime of Our Time, about it. I made a film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, an earlier film, In Debt We Trust. But now, finally, the mainstream or lamestream media is picking up on this because the facts are unassailable. And I know this has been something you've been looking into as well, Russ, haven't you?
I mean, a hat tip to you for your terrific films, which I've seen, and your books, and your continued vigilance and early presence on the scene of all of these issues. You're a great American, and it's great that you're on the radio.
I've been called many things, okay, in my life. A great American is not one of them, and I'm proud. I'm very proud. In fact, I am saluting as I speak to you to thank you for calling me a great American.
Yeah, well,
you're the first, Russ.
Well, we're taking back the language.
Okay.
So, in terms of all these things, the woman who just called in, your colleague was talking about the, you know, wondering if there was not more going on. I just want to address that for a second because, as you know, I wrote a book, Family of Secrets, which is all about very deep and dark things behind the rise of the Bush family, what have you. And my colleagues and my friends in the mainstream media were terrified of this book because it kind of gets into that little area that is always dismissed as sort of conspiracy, you know, the notion that there could possibly be more going on than the way that the media treats things. The reality is that the public has lost faith that it's getting the real story. And so what happens is there is this sort of proliferation of rumors and speculation moves so fast. And so whereas part of the population always believes whatever they're told, the other part of the population never believes what they're told by the official sources. But they easily believe anything that sounds particularly heinous and comes to them via email and so forth. And neither of those is right. One of my concerns, and I know you're that way too with your show, we're that way with whowhatwhy.com, is that we want to get there in that sweet spot in the center where we actually try to figure out what happened. And it's entirely possible that there are more to some of these stories. We don't know. Anything is possible. I mean,
when was the last time you heard a sentence like this in a newspaper like the Wall Street Journal? Listen to this sentence today. I mean, this is Rupert Murdoch's prize publication. Authorities in the U.S., U.K., and Switzerland alleged a vast conspiracy led by UBS to rig benchmark rates. The bank agreed to pay about $1.5 billion to settle these charges. So, you know, if you stay around long enough and you pound away hard enough on these issues, truth will come out. And, you know, in fact, even the big media, which has obscured these issues for years and denied them and attacked people like yourself who are raising these questions, suddenly have to acknowledge that, in fact, rigging in an epic plot took place. And the bank has been fined over $1 billion. I mean, this is hallelujah. You know,
that's right, but that's not the whole story. In fact, that bank and other banks are constantly rigging everything, including parts of our political system. And for more on that, if you go to our site, whowhatwhy.com, just go to the search box and type in UBS. And you'll read articles that we've done over the years about the very close relationship between UBS and, for example, the Clintons and Barack Obama. Now, this is not going to be in that Rupert Murdoch article. That I think it's relevant that Barack Obama, for three years in a row, when he went on vacation to Martha's Vineyard, he spent a good part of his vacation golfing with in his foursome the head of UBS. I mean, how is that not something that the media ought to be talking about and wondering if, in fact, UBS was involved in a giant conspiracy, that impacts all of our economic systems? Why are they not interested in UBS's personal relationship with the President of the United States?
Well, guess what, Russ? This issue has now been mentioned in the media, or at least on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. Thank you so much for joining me today and sharing some of your insights on this issue. Your website is indispensable, whowhatwhy.com. Check it out, everybody. Now we're moving on. Since we're talking about finance, I'd like to play a little tune for you as we move into the next segment from my film, In Debt We Trust, the In Debt We Trust anthem. Take it away.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo.
Ça, les ambiances cool, la folie du Congo, yeah, yeah. Des 143, DJ Mounia, yeah, my man Bex, ok, Kinshasa, Naleli, Naleli, chip, 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 aïe, Kinshasa, des 143, ici on fout le feu, mais pas dans le même endroit, les ambiances classe, les ambiances cool, à Kinshasa on aime faire le fou. Des bandales machines à matongé. Ici y'a pas trop de lingué. Avec la musique de Wengé. Ici on connaît pas les merengués. Alors on va pas s'égarer. A Kinshasa, matches à carré. Chintunga, wou, wou, wou. Chintunga, wa, wa, wa.
Kinshasa, Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It's rocking the Congo, and the man who's rocking the Congo is here in our studio today. Say hello to Dijak Munya, and Heather Davis is here with us to help translate. We're going to play a few of his songs. We're going to hear a little bit about what's happening in the Congo and a little bit more about him. Dijak, tell us about yourself as a musician and an artist. How did you get going and what kind of music do you do?
Si tu peux donner quelques détails par rapport à toi comme artiste et musicien, comment est-ce que tu as commencé et qu'est-ce qui est en train d'être fait maintenant?
Voilà, merci d'abord de m'avoir reçu.
Thank you very much for having me.
de New York City. Je suis très heureux d'être dans votre station de radio aujourd'hui.
I'm very happy to be here in New York, voilà, at your radio station today.
Voilà pour la petite histoire. DJ Akmouni a commencé à Kinshasa, dans le quartier chaud de Kinshasa, à Bandal.
DJ Akmouni started in the neighborhood of Bandal in Kinshasa.
Et puis voilà, depuis l'âge de 13 ans, 14 ans que j'ai commencé à faire la musique.
Since the age of 13, I've been doing music.
Et puis après, je me suis lancé petit à petit, pendant que les gens ne croyaient pas à cette musique qu'on faisait, qui est le hip-hop au Congo.
I've been building slowly as hip-hop didn't start with a really strong backing in Kinshasa.
Alors après avoir fait plusieurs concerts dans les rues de Kin, dans des espaces culturels.
After doing several performances in the street and at different cultural centers around Kinshasa.
Et voilà, aujourd'hui, je suis venu parce que je suis en train de préparer mon deuxième album, parce que le premier, je le fais avec la participation d'un autre artiste qui s'appelle Papa Wemba, qui est l'un de très grands musiciens au Congo.
And after that, there started to be a little bit more success, and I'm working on putting out my second album right now after having put out a first album a few years ago, in which I collaborated with Papa Wemba, amongst others, who's a very well-known Congolese musician.
Papa Wemba is one of the giants of Congolese music. In fact, Congolese music itself is considered by many the best music in Africa, if not the world. It has a tremendous following. It plays a really dynamic role in the culture there. It's admired by people in other African countries who are not French-speaking. It has a dynamo to it. I've gone to some shows at the Manhattan Center here in New York of Congolese music, packed by Africans from all over the continent. Pretty impressive, pretty amazing. And I happen to be in Kinshasa, doing a film there about a peace process, which didn't really take off, but which we hoped would. And I met a group there. I went outside of the city, and I met a group called War Child that was meeting with and trying to help young children who were the victims of war. And it was there that I met Nidjak, who was actually working with these artists, as an artist, with these children, doing songs, doing rap competitions, and all kinds of ways to engage them in expressing themselves, because many of these kids can be traumatized by their experience, you know, experiences of rape, torture, abuse, you know, on a horrific scale. It's been said, you know, 6 million people have died in the war in Congo, which is really considered a world war, not just a conflict. And it's been going on for such a long time. And Nidjak got involved as a human rights activist to some degree, you know, to try to do something with his art and his creativity. What's been your experience in this era of working with these children of war?
Est-ce que tu peux décrire un peu son expérience en travaillant avec les enfants qui ont été les victimes de la guerre et le travail avec les ONG comme War Child UK?
Oui, ça fait plusieurs années déjà que je travaille avec les ONG internationales au niveau du Congo, avec pour la protection des enfants et victimes de guerre, les enfants de la rue. Ce ne sont pas vraiment les enfants de la rue, ce sont les enfants que certaines personnes mettent dans la rue. Et avec l'autre volet, avec les filles violées qui sont victimes des guerres sur le violence sexuelle faite à la femme.
So I've worked for several years with a number of different international NGOs, working with children in need of protection, children who have been victims of war, as you've said. Also, I've worked with children who are street kids that have been put out of their homes by their own families, and also with people, especially girls and women, that are survivors of rape.
And one of the things about these children in Kinshasa, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, one of the things that amazed me, you know, was really hard to even comprehend, is that a lot of these children don't even eat every day. They eat, you know, once in a while. They're in a sense starving. They're starving for affection. They're starving for support. And the people are so preoccupied with their problems of survival that these children tend to get ignored or at least neglected. And yet, you know, you, among other artists, have stepped up to the plate to work with these children. How do you feel doing it as a you know, in your own country, working with these children, seeing what's happening and seeing how these children's needs are not being met.
Bon, c'est évident que les enfants ont des grands, grands besoins. Même on ne mange pas chaque jour et on n'a pas assez d'affection, d'appui. Et c'est très difficile pour eux parce que les gens en général se concernent avec eux-mêmes et leur propre survival. Mm-hmm. Quoi. Et tu as travaillé avec ces enfants parmi autres artistes. Et comment est-ce que tu te sens par rapport à ce travail quand tu vois ces enfants? Et tu vois que les difficultés qu'il y a.
Ce n'est pas très facile de travailler dans des conditions difficiles d'abord avec ces enfants-là, parce que quand tu viens travailler avec eux, au départ, ils pensent que tu viens les apporter des solutions directement. Or, ces enfants-là, ils sont que victimes, en fait, du système. À la fois abandonnés par le parent, à la fois abandonnés par le gouvernement. Et le système fait que, tu vois, tu trouves les enfants les plus petits, les mineurs dans la rue, et travailler avec eux, c'est une expérience qui te fait mal, parce que moi, en tant que parent aussi, en tant que grand frère, tu as très mal, et la seule chose que tu peux faire, c'est de pouvoir dire, les aider eux à pouvoir dire très haut, musicalement, c'est que les autres n'arrivent pas à dire, et pouvoir condamner, pouvoir dire qu'il faut qu'il y ait des changements par rapport à la situation qui se passe. Il faut qu'il y ait aussi des lois pour pouvoir condamner sérieusement tous ces problèmes.
It's a very, very difficult situation. Working with these kids, initially, they expect you that maybe you're going to bring something directly to them to distribute. But not only have they been victims of potentially their families, but also victims of the system in general, and of the government. And you see very, all ages of kids, even tiny children who have not been taken care of by their families. And, it makes them feel bad. He's a parent also, and, he understands the difficulties that kids face in the street, and he's the best that he can do is to bring this message that there needs to be a change in the system and in the laws that are and in the enforcement of laws to protect children.
See, I don't think people really understand that the Democratic Republic of the Congo is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. It has diamonds. It has all kinds of minerals. It has coltan, which is the metals that go into our cell phones. We are connected. Every time we pick up an iPhone, every time we pick up an Android phone, we are connected to the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We don't know it. We don't are not aware of it. And the wealth there has been stripped away, and there's been a war for not for peace in the Congo, but for a peace of the Congo with African countries, neighboring countries, as well as groups within the Congo, basically taking what they can. And the people are suffering there in a horrendous way, and nobody talks about it. We just saw a report that a so-called rebel group had basically threatened to take over one of the towns in the eastern Congo, in Goma. There's a whole force of UN peacekeepers there who were powerless. Other of the Congolese army, powerless. These people were about to rampage through Goma and through the whole country. Did we hear anything from the United States government to stop this, to do something about this? Yes, there was some lip service paid, but nothing seriously done to protect a population that's being menaced. You remember how we were bombing Libya to protect people from being killed by Gaddafi, so we were killing them in a way. But this whole situation in the Congo has sort of receded to the back pages, and it's only people on the front lines, like Djack Munya here, who has been consistently engaged, and it's not so easy. It's risky. I mean, there was another singer, apparently, he was jailed, a rapper, in the Congo because the government or somebody in the government didn't like what he was saying. You operate in an environment of fear. True?
Est-ce que c'est vrai que, en fait, les artistes font leur travail dans un environnement de la peur?
Oui, exactement, parce que nous sommes déjà... Dans le pays, comme moi, tu as des choses que tu voudrais dire au fond de toi, mais que tu n'arrives pas à les dire parce que tu sais déjà que le système va pouvoir t'empêcher de pouvoir dire certaines choses.
Yeah, it's very difficult to do work there when you know that the government is listening out for you and you want to say certain things, but it can pose a personal danger.
You know, and I have to say how, in a way, lucky I was to meet you, dear Jack, to meet your children, to visit you in your home, to visit you, you know, working with War Child, to see the tremendous struggle that's taking place there of ordinary people trying to make a difference in this country without the support that they deserve, without the media attention they deserve. And when you and I met and we clicked, we connected, you know, we talked about you'll come to New York. Well, that was 2009. Now, 2012, 3 years later, here you are on the radio at Progressive Radio Network, a small miracle and in a time of miracles. And I'm so proud, you know, that to know you and to have you here. And here's another one of your songs. How do you say it exactly? Tell me.
L'Estoile.
L'Estoile. I'm sorry, everybody, for butchering this beautiful language. But it's a song about Heather.
Bon, est-ce que tu peux introduire la chanson?
Voilà, la chanson, c'est L'Estoile, l'histoire de se détendre, de pousser tout le monde, de pousser les chaises, de se mettre au salon parce qu'on va vraiment bouger, parce que c'est un son, il faut être dans le move à fond.
Yeah, this is a dance song, so push back all the chairs from the living room, get up and move a little bit.
Go for it, maestro.
Keep. Okay.
Bouge ton pompon d'air. Bouge ton pompon d'air.
Okay.
Patouka, poufou. Banabaka sandomoka.
Bijak Mounia.
Bill Clinton. Banabaka sandomoka. Bouge ton pompon d'air. Bouge ton pompon d'air.
On met la vibe, aïe, ok. Qui, bébé, laisse-toi aller, laisse-moi t'emmener, ensemble on va s'envoler. Mama Yaka, Dobina dans sa bayaka. Kachu, tu veux voir le soleil briller comme l'étoile, laisse tes émotions pousser comme les poils. Qui t'a dit que le ciel va tomber, qu'il faut vite prier, c'est juste pour t'embêter. Viens me voir, qu'on brise toutes tes règles, qu'on gagne notre règne, que tu vives comme une reine. T'en envie alors laisse-toi emballer, viens, qu'on brise nos étapes. Bouge ton hanche, danse quoi ça, si Jack Mounia a zopé ça pour ça. Laisse-toi aller, viens qu'on fasse des choses, qu'on fasse parler les mots, voyez-moi c'est pour la live.
Move,
ok.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. We're all boogieing here in the studio. By the way, here's a Facebook page for Dijak's work. Write this down and check him out and become a friend of Dijak Mounia. Facebook.com/Dijak Mounia, MUNYA, Officiel, OFFICIEL. I think I got that right. So that's one way to stay in touch with Dijak Mounia and his music, which is so powerful and so terrific. Fill us in a little. Tell us a little bit about what your understanding is of what's happening in the Eastern Congo, where this M23 so-called rebel group emerged out of almost nowhere and threatened to overrun the town of Goma and even Kinshasa itself.
Est-ce que tu peux donner un peu des détails de ta compréhension par rapport à la situation à l'Est avec le M23?
C'est bien triste parce que la population de l'Est, on a l'impression que ça fait une éternité qu'ils sont victimes de guerre.
It's sad because the population in the East, you know, we have the sense that it's really been an eternity that they've spent in the midst of war.
En gros, quand on regarde la situation, c'est juste par rapport aux intérêts de la richesse qu'il y a dans ces régions-là.
And when you look at the region, it's really a lot of parties that are interested in the riches that that region holds.
Parce que c'est bien triste parce que aujourd'hui, on trouve même certaines les Congolais. On parle du Rwanda, mais on voit la communauté internationale en train de condamner les choses, mais qui n'agissent pas par rapport à la population. Aujourd'hui, j'ai vu ce qui s'est passé aux États-Unis par rapport à la mort des enfants. Je suis très touché par rapport à toutes ces victimes et à ces parents qui ont perdu ces enfants. Mais au Congo, il y a des milliers des enfants qui meurent chaque jour.
It's very difficult because when you look at all the different parties that are interested in what's going on in Eastern Congo in terms of the commerce, there really doesn't appear to be a lot of action taken. And, you know, I heard about the shooting that happened here in Connecticut, and I was very touched by that, and my heart really goes out to the parents that have lost their children. And at the same time, you know, we're talking about millions in Congo that are suffering, and there's a real lack of action.
I have to tell you that, you know, Congo was part of what awakened me to Africa and to African issues, which really affected my life and led to my being involved with South Africa for so many years and making so many movies. When I was a student at Cornell University in 1961, the head of prime minister of Congo, who had been leading the fight for independence against the Belgian colonialists, one of the most vicious colonial powers of all time, Patrice Lumumba, was assassinated. And later we learned the CIA was involved and Mobutu was involved in this murder. And I was one of the students at Cornell who marched on the campus in honor of Lumumba, to remember Lumumba, to call for an investigation of this this assassination. And we confronted at the time the campus conservative society that had built a little fire there, and they said like they were cooking people. They were calling the African people cannibals. And it was a disgraceful protest, display of racism in front of the Willard Straight Hall at Cornell University. And getting involved in that in 1961 really opened my mind to what was happening in Africa. And later, when I went to the Congo in 2009, so many years later, I met Lumumba's son, which I was really honored to meet him and was welcomed by his family. So, you know, how an event that happened a world away to a bunch of kids who nobody in Africa knew anything about really affected their lives. And the Congo has been part of that. And Djack Munya has been like a voice to some degree in the wilderness, but not anymore, because we've got to not only get to know him and his music, but to introduce him to other artists. I did today with Polarity One down in Tribeca, and I think the two of them might collaborate. So this is the start of a connection, and having him here, this is his first American radio interview on Progressive Radio Network. It's a start to introduce Djack. And I just wanted to share one of his songs at this point. We have one more to go, but this is called My Dream. Check this out.
Yeah. Okay.
My dream.
My dream.
My dream.
Okay.
Oh, my dream. Oh, my dream.
It's a doto.
Oh, my dream.
My dream. My dream.
Oh, my dream.
My dream.
Oh, my dream.
It's a doto.
Oh, my dream.
Hi. Un jour je fais un rêve. Dans mon rêve, ma vie ne pense si glissante que dans la réalité. Dans mon rêve, les enfants ne sont pas intégrés dans l'armée pour être envoyés au combat. Kids avant au plus bas, ceux qui ne s'enrôlent pas. En but de ton frère pour des raisons qu'on ne connaît pas. Dans mon rêve, je suis cet enfant qui va à l'école sac au dos et non celui qui porte le fardeau. Dans mon rêve, je suis pas cet enfant que la rue a pris dans ses bras. Que les gens veulent l'enfant chégué. Je vis comme un clandestin, tout seul comme un orphelin. Dans la rue, je crève de faim, je prie à la pour mon destin. Ma vie se dessine dans le noir. Je regarde le ciel, je nage dans le vide. Depuis hier, j'ai rien dans le mobile. Je croise les doigts, mais qui sera mon guide?
My dream,
my dream.
My dream.
My dream.
My dream.
Et un doto. My dream, my dream, ok. Dans mon rêve, je vis comme un enfant normal, pas comme un animal qu'on doit attraper. Choper, saigner dans sa cellule.
What is that dream, Djack? Tell us what the song is. What are you saying in that song?
Qu'est-ce que tu dis dans la chanson, si tu peux expliquer?
Dans la chanson, quand on parlait justement des enfants, je me mets dans la peau de ces enfants-là. Je parle de ce qu'ils ressentent, ces enfants-là, parce que ça fait des années que je travaille avec les enfants qui sont dans la souffrance, dans la rue, victimes de guerre. Et dans la chanson, ils disent, dans mon rêve, je rêve d'avoir une vie normale, comme tous les enfants du monde. Pas être un enfant seul, pas être enrôlé dans l'armée, pas être dans la rue, commencer à demander, pas être obligé de voler. Les jeunes filles, les mineurs qui sont violées, elles veulent être quelque part, elles ont un rêve. Elles disent, dans mon rêve, la nourriture n'est pas spéciale. Dans mon rêve, je vais à l'école comme tous les enfants. Ils ont un rêve qu'ils veulent réaliser. Alors dans la chanson, ils disent, ce n'est qu'un rêve. Alors c'est pour cela que je dis à tous les dirigeants, aux parents, au gouvernement, à tout le monde, à toutes ces institutions, qu'il est temps d'aider ces enfants.
So in this song, I'm putting myself in place of the children, inside their skin, to describe their experience, as I've spent a lot of time working with them. And the dream basically is for these children to have a normal life, that they're not in the street, that they're not obliged to steal, that they're not victims of war, that they're not, taken in by war, that girls that I have met who are survivors of rape, they have dreams of going to school. I mean, it's as simple as that. And in their minds, they're saying, this is nothing but a dream for me. I don't even know. I don't want to have to figure out where I'm getting food. But his message is that something needs to change on the level of the government, and that we need to make this dream a reality for these kids.
Well, you know, a sentiment that I think we can all identify with, eloquently expressed in song, beautifully expressed in song, very moving. Dijak Munya is an artist that really we want to introduce you to. I don't think you'd hear him on other stations. Here we are on Progressive Radio Network, PRN-FM, on News Dissector Radio, and we're bringing you the world. We're bringing you the voices of the world, voices that we don't hear because we like to listen to our own voices only. We don't listen to the voices of others. And in listening and meeting Dijak Munya, I was so impressed with him, and I'm never thought I would get the opportunity to really present him to you on our radio show. He does have an album. Is there a number or a website that we can? We said there's a Facebook.com Dijak Munya Oficiel. Is there any other way to contact him?
There is a website that's under construction, which is djakmunya.com, djakmunya.com. And there's also one single right now that's up for sale, which is called Mukusa, which is on gumroad.com. If you look up Dijak Munya on gumroad.com.
Well, there you go. One of the world artists, believe me, that you will be hearing a lot more of. I was in Jamaica back in the early 70s with the early reggae artists, okay? Peter Tosh, Marley. None of them had really taken off. Our radio station in Boston, WBCN, began playing The Harder They Come, one album, Jimmy Cliff. And that helped create a whole global phenomenon. I know it did. I know it started in Jamaica, but it was echoed by WBCN and by a few other radio stations, and it took off. The same thing is going to happen for Dijak Munya. Trust me on this. It's going to happen because the quality of his music is so strong and so good. So please remember this name and check out his music and see if you can't help spread the word about this music, because what's happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo is a crime. It's a crime against humanity. And it's something that we have to try to play some role in stopping and addressing. And one way to do it is to connect with people there who are on, who are trying as hard as they can to bring these issues to world attention. They're doing it through literature. They're doing it through protests. They're doing it through music. And that's why I'm so pleased that he was able to be here with us. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector. I wanted to announce that MediaChannel.org, the website that I was one of the co-founders of back in 2000, is coming back online after a horrible experience of having been, in a way, hijacked. But we're back. And if you look at my blog, newsdissector.net, there's an appeal for support to help us strengthen MediaChannel.org, to hold the media's feet to the fire, to try to tell the truth about what's really happening in our world. So that is something which I call to your attention. I'm also a writer. My book Blogathon, my book Occupy, Dissecting Occupy Wall Street, are out from Cosimo Press. They're available from Amazon.com. So write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Tell me how you feel about our radio show. Suggest people. Thank you, Catherine, for calling. Kat is with us every week. She couldn't be with us today. But as you see, there's been so much happening here on the air. We want to go out with one final song by my friend Dijak Munya. I want to thank Heather, you for being here with us. We're on our way to a party of the Global Information Network and the Sahara Television, Sahara reporters that do Sahara TV, which is a African program that's on YouTube that you should check out. If you've never seen it, you'll be very impressed by it. So there is an effort by Africa to tell its own story, to have its own voices get heard, and I wanted, to what little degree I can, help on that front. So here we're going out tonight and wishing everyone a happy holiday, wishing everybody season's greetings in this, quote, season to be jolly, which is not so jolly. Nakunzanga, check it out. To Jack Munya.
Ok, loin des yeux près du cœur, ce frère on le dit, une main sur le cœur, dans la Lely, des Kinshasa, Paris, des Paris à Kinshasa, il y en a qui ont le blues, mais gamin qui le move, donc il y en a Moussika, voilà pour le caca, des bébés babunga, Bolingo Yamboka, Nyonso Anassé, Bona Bampiaka, Bissoto, Mbate, Doko Bakaka, Tiko Rarara, Bissoto, Sokova, Koba, Bolingo Yamboka, Neko, Rezana, Monte, Maneko, la chaleur.